This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Trader on Barron's Live. I'm Eric Savitz. I'm a tech reporter for Barron's Magazine. I am excited to have joining me today, Chris Cappicella, who is the Chief Marketing Officer at Microsoft and a lifer at Microsoft who's been there. I think you just hit your 30th anniversary. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yes, it is in July.
It's remarkable. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. There's so much to talk about here. I want to talk first a little bit about what Microsoft has gone through over the last couple of years going through the pandemic. This has been a remarkable period for the company. I mean, obviously lots of very difficult times for everyone inside Microsoft and elsewhere, but it has fundamentally affected the business in some positive ways, ironically. Talk a little bit about how Microsoft has been transformed in this period, both from in terms of the way the business is positioned, but also how it's affected the way that you do business and the way that you reach your customers, which is, you know, clearly part of your job.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Eric, thanks obviously for having me. It's good to get a chance to chat. You know, I think that the key thing for us was realizing that with the pandemic, and really, frankly, with any crisis management that we do, the number one priority has to be the well-being and safety of our employees. And when you prioritize that first, that then obviously allows you to keep your company running. It allows you to keep the systems that your customers depend on going. And Satya often talks about, hey, I want us to think about Microsoft as being the digital first responders for the world's actual first responders. So, you know, we have a crisis management team that meets very frequently and is constantly looking at what is going on with our employees? How are we doing? What new procedures or policies do we have to put in place? And, you know, we discovered a bunch of interesting things. First of all, we discovered that we really could work remotely and keep the company running very well.
And just to put some structure around this, how many employees are there at Microsoft these days?
Yeah, we have about 190,000 employees. We have offices in about 104 different countries around the world. Right. About 100,000 of those are in the U.S. So it's incredibly geographically dispersed. And we've set up crisis management teams in about 60 different locations to look after those 104 different country sites where the 190,000 people work.
And how quickly did you go from sort of normal operations to everyone goes home or as much as possible?
Well, it happened very quickly for our employees in China. You know, you go back and obviously everyone knows the history there. And we quickly moved to a mandatory work from home mode in China. And we're a relatively, you know, one Microsoft company. We don't have a lot of like random little subsidiaries off, you know, in that corner or not. So the senior leadership team was very close to what was happening in China. And then in March, you know, when it came to the US in particular, right in Kirkland, Washington was the first location that got hit hard in the United States. That is our backyard. A lot of employees live in Kirkland. March 22nd, I think it was, we went mandatory work from home for everybody in the US and, you know, pretty much in the world at that point. So it was relatively quick because we have a big set of employees in China that we were already in lockdown mode around.
And how worried were you at the time that this would turn out to be not just obviously it was a disruption to your business, it was a disruption to everybody's business, but that it would turn out to be a real blow to the business, which is not really how it played out at all. Like Microsoft has had fantastic quarterly results all through this period and continues to do that. You know, the stock's near an all-time record high. Everything is going very well fundamentally for the company, but that was probably not clear last March, I would presume.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we didn't know that it would last this long. So we felt like we were in sort of a, hey, how productive can we be? How do we keep our employees safe? And we started measuring really obvious things for a software company, like pull requests for developers, how productive are developers being? And, you know, we saw that working from home didn't really negatively impact the productivity. There are a couple little spots that we had to worry perhaps more about. Software game development is quite tricky to do totally remotely. But by and large, because of the tool set that we have, things like Microsoft Teams, our developer tool set that we use, the virtualization that we can use, et cetera, we were surprised how productive the company could still be. And we were focused more on figuring out, you know, how do we take care of our vendors who now there's no cafeteria to support, there are no shuttles to drive, et cetera. What can we do to help the local community in all the communities we do business? So it became less about can Microsoft run, and it became more about what are the things we should do given the circumstances are so incredibly unique to support the community where we have lots of employees.
You know, one of the things that's happened, and Satya Nadella talked about this within a quarter or two of the onset of the pandemic, is that there's really been this acceleration of, risk of sounding a little jargony, of digital transformation, right? So you have businesses, and what that gets to at the core, I think, is businesses that were operating in a physical way have had to maintain their businesses to be more aggressive about adopting digital technology and cloud technology that's been helpful for your business. Clearly, how much do you see that as a temporary like sort of spike in an otherwise existing trend, as opposed to a real change in the pace at which businesses are shifting their businesses to required, you know, digital technology to drive what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the number one thing is it's a major culture change when a company is forced to realize, oh, I've got to respond to this. I've got to then recover for it and from it. And I get to actually reimagine what I was doing. So we've seen industries that were perhaps slower moving be forced to go very fast. And once they do, and they start to discover, oh my gosh, I can do curbside check-in now, and I couldn't do that before. I can literally deliver, a retailer can deliver products to someone's car because they were forced to. Oh, what else can we do that is so transformative? So, you know, Eric, you're going to find pockets where as people return more to the workplace or as kids return to school, there'll be a technology, you know, rebalancing where they're not sitting in front of their screens all day, which is great. But by and large, for a company like Microsoft, I think, more companies have realized that they can be bolder about their use of technology. And so that will, I think, cause a more permanent shift to adoption of tech in really interesting ways. And that is financial services, that's healthcare, that's, you know, the list goes on and on, retail, obviously. So I'd say little pockets that will go up and down based on what's going on in the pandemic, but broadly speaking, a huge embrace of technology that I don't think goes back.
It's a one-way street.
Certainly what we're seeing from customers, look at, you know, the number one thing we see CEOs struggling with right now is that they hear from their employees that a lot of employees want to go back to the office so that they can focus and get more focus time and be social, et cetera. And a lot of employees want to stay working from home because they get to focus better. The same notion has people wanting both things. And Satya calls this the hybrid paradox. Right. People want the flexibility to work from anywhere, but they also crave more in-person connection. And so, you know, does that mean products like Teams are going to get used less? I don't think so. I think it means they're going to get used more as CEOs really, you know, try to figure out what are our workplace policies so that my employees get what they want, flexibility, but also in-person connection. So that's one of the really interesting things that's come out of the pandemic is this sort of hybrid paradox. And then if you listen to LinkedIn, Ryan Roslansky is the CEO there. He talks about this great reshuffle where we see, you know, lots of people went home to work. And over the past 18 months, they're sort of rethinking not just like, oh, where do I work and what hours do I work? But they're also kind of thinking about why do I work? And, you know, that's causing a lot of companies to see increased attrition and shuffling around of jobs. And those two trends, the great reshuffle and the hybrid paradox, I think are some of the more interesting trends that are pandemic-led that CEOs and their leadership teams are frankly trying to deal with.
So, Crystal, how is Microsoft dealing with those questions internally? So, for example, what is your plan? I know you guys have talked about this some, but what is your plan on return to the office? What are you expecting employees to do? What is your position on, say, people who have, you know, relocated and suddenly they're, instead of living in Seattle, they're living in, you know, I don't know, in the mountains someplace, and they perfectly, and they have great internet access. And so they think they can work from there forever. Maybe they fly to Redmond once a quarter. I mean, like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, Eric, is like, we're very humble in this space. We're trying to be students of the times. We don't feel like we know all the answers, but there's no doubt that we used to be a company that was very much about, oh, everyone should be in like our Redmond headquarters or whatever. Those days are over. We realize now that, you know, flexibility is the name of the game. And there is no one size fits all approach. So during the pandemic, we came up with brand new sort of flexible work guidelines for our employees. And they include employees having the option, if it works for their job, to work, you know, very remotely, not even with an office of other Microsoft people. And to your point, like, they're in Montana or they're in, you know, upstate New York or wherever. And if it works for their role and it works with their manager, then they're fully empowered to do that. Other people we know really yearn for those hallway chats. And so we've opened up many of our campuses around the world, many of our work sites around the world, and people can still work from home, but they can come in. And we're starting to see more and more people come into our offices in different locations. They, believe it or not, they really want the food service. They want the social interaction. And yet, will they come to work 5 days a week? Probably not. So I think what we've learned is that we've got to provide incredible flexibility for employees to decide, you know, what works well for them. And of course, for managers to make sure that they're establishing team norms so that, you know, things can work for them as well. And that's it in a nutshell. It's all about flexibility. It's all about not pretending there's a one size fits all approach. And I love it. I think it's a huge positive change for the company culture.
So, you mentioned Teams, and I did want to talk about Teams.
Okay.
So, Teams has had a remarkable period of growth and just visibility over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's gone from like a product that not that many people, I think, were using or knew about to a huge growth spurt. And Teams, of course, is a collaborative communications product. Talk a little bit about Teams and the journey that it's gone through and the way the pandemic has impacted the adoption rate, which I assume has really been a positive effect on Teams.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, a couple of years ago, it was at, you know, tens of millions of monthly active users. And now we're at, you know, 250 million monthly active users. So it's gone through just incredibly explosive growth in the education space, in the enterprise space, the commercial space, small businesses, and now even consumers, as we have launched sort of a consumer version of Teams. But I think the key thing for us is that obviously the pandemic meant that people needed a tool to allow them to work remotely. And, you know, our two big competitors historically in this space have been Slack, which has done very well with things like persistent chat, and also Zoom, which has done very well with things like video conferencing. But Teams is the thing that brings chat, video conferencing, meetings, phone calls, and office collaboration on documents and whiteboards into a single UI. And so we have had a lot of customers say, gosh, if I can just buy Teams and I don't have to buy these other things from other companies, bringing that all together is powerful. And originally, Eric, it was all about chat and it was all about meetings. That's where we saw the vast majority of usage. But the thing that I've been surprised by is actually how customers are using it as almost a dashboard and a single user interface for a lot of business processes. Mm-hmm. So we've seen like frontline workers at retailers like Marks and Spencer, they've rolled out Teams to their retail salespeople on the floor of a Marks and Spencer, and they use their phone, they use Teams that might look different than the Teams you and I use, because they've really simplified it and customized it to doing shift, you know, scheduling and checking in and checking out from a shift, looking up product information. So it's really become sort of a central hub for business to get done. It isn't just a video chat, sorry, just a video conferencing thing or a chat thing. And I think that's stickier. I think that's more interesting to a company like a Marks and Spencer than just, you know, oh yeah, we use it for our video stuff. And so I actually feel like it's what started out as, oh, this is, you know, Zoom and Slack put together plus Office collaboration, et cetera, has now become much more of a, you know, it's almost an app platform where we see companies putting apps inside of the Teams UI, if that makes sense.
You know, it's interesting because there's sort of an internal, as you well know, there's sort of an internal endless debate in the software industry about best of breed versus sort of integrated tools.
Right.
And this feels exactly like an example of that. Now, you could argue, by the way, I think it would be fair. You could say, argue that, well, we're better than Slack at that and what Slack does, or I mean, I'm making a judgment call here, but I mean, you can make that kind of positioning. But it does raise this interesting question about whether customers would prefer to pick and choose, like, I want this for that, I want to use this app for that, as opposed to like an integrated set of tools.
Yeah.
Right. And that's sort of, that's always been the like Microsoft's positioning, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally true, and that I think that tension or that question will exist, you know, forever. I would say in the early days of cloud, we saw a lot of customers betting on a single cloud platform, AWS, and over time they started saying, I'm not sure if A, they have everything I need, but B, I'm not sure if I want to only work with one cloud provider. So there's also the question of just having a multi-vendor strategy. You know, you fast forward 6 or 7 years, and it's very rare to find a customer who only wants to work with AWS or only wants to work with Azure or only wants to work with any of the cloud providers. And they're typically balancing their vendor pool. And I think that integrated suite versus best of breed, it's that constant tension. Right. You take a look at something like security, and we see customer after customer embracing our security products and frankly, simplifying from 80 different vendors down to 15. Yeah, it's a miracle.
That is an interesting point, Chris, because in the security market, it has all, there's never been a single there has never been a, like, you know, an all integrated like security solution. There's never even been a company. I mean, there are large security software companies, but nothing the equivalent of a Microsoft, say, that can provide that kind of complete coverage. And I always thought that it was in part because the problem set keeps changing, right? So it was antivirus, and then it was firewalls, and it's been other things along the
line. I do think it's an incredibly vibrant space. Even the most progressive sort of digital transformation officers, if they can get down to 5 security vendors, you know, they would think that was a huge success.
Right.
It's also one of those things where, you know, extra insurance isn't always a bad thing.
Right.
So companies are always worried about, you know, being exposed. So security has just been a huge business for us. We announced, you know, it's over $10 billion for us. We are the largest security company in the world, which is kind of surprising to most people. And yet, I don't know that we'd ever tell a customer, you know, oh, you should only have one security partner. It's just, I do think the tech world is a multi-vendor world, whether that's security or public cloud or many other things. There are a handful of things where you'd say you probably only need one of these. Email is a good example. It's very rare to find a company that's running 2 email systems internally.
Yeah.
But, you know, for public cloud infrastructure, for security, et cetera, I think you're going to find it's a multi-vendor world. And it's a balance of, you know, best of breed, very narrow tools with, you know, integrated suites that make the licensing and the support simpler and, you know, give you a single tool to that everyone can kind of rally around.
So
answer for you, Eric.
That's helpful. So that raises sort of another question, which is when you think about the cloud business, and obviously the cloud has turned into a gigantic business for Microsoft. The whole business is sort of run from the cloud now.
Yep.
But when you think particularly about Azure and the public cloud, where you have a couple of, you know, like minor competitors, right? Like Amazon and Google.
And I
guess you could argue, and maybe Oracle and IBM and Alibaba. But the interesting question, in a way, is to your point, lots of customers, probably most of your customers, are using multiple clouds, and it raises the question about your ability to offer hybrid cloud sort of infrastructure for people to manage those things. When there are third parties like VMware or others who are trying to be sort of Switzerland, and they will always argue, that it's hard for you to be kind of an impartial player in a market where you're also one of the, you're trying to manage a hybrid cloud strategy when you are one of the clouds that's being managed. How do you think about that and the importance of those sort of hybrid cloud tools that every customer's coming to rely on?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things for people to realize is that we've totally transformed our business model from the traditional, how many Windows servers can we sell? How many, Windows PCs can we sell? And now it's a consumption-based model where we only succeed with things like Azure if our customers are thriving and if the tools, if the services they use in Azure are spinning more and more and more. So if a customer is thriving and opening up new business, new stores or hiring more employees and having to provide, more capacity for whatever they've built on top of Azure, then Microsoft is going to do well. What that has forced us to do really 10 years ago is to really embrace traditionally competing technologies, like let's say Linux, and say, no, Azure can absolutely thrive if a customer wants to run Linux for what they need in our cloud. So Azure gives you every flavor of Linux you could possibly want. Databases, very similar. Rather than being beholden to SQL Server success, Azure and Microsoft can succeed with whatever database you would like to run if you run it on Azure. And so Satya has effectively, I think, changed the mindset of our own teams to say, hey, whatever technology the customer wants, we need to provide that. We need to provide it through GitHub for developers. We need to provide it through Azure for databases and virtualization technology. Don't be beholden to our traditional things. And so I think that's sort of opened people's minds. Today, more Linux workloads run on Azure than Windows workloads. And the Linux workloads are growing faster. So, and yet Azure's thriving because of that shift to a consumption-based sort of business model. Our security business will only succeed if we can help you secure things running in AWS, things running in Google Cloud Platform, things running on Linux servers in your own data center, things running on Macs on your employees', desktops. So I just think we've moved on from feeling like it has to be, a Microsoft stack for us to succeed. Security, there's no way that'll work. Azure, there's no way that'll work. Even Microsoft 365, it runs on Macs, it runs on iPads, iPhones, Android devices. And that's part of why it works. That's part of what people like about it.
Right. So I want to change gears a little bit and talk and shift sort of the consumer side of your business a little
bit.
You have a prop standing behind you. So let's talk a little bit about Xbox and in particular, how Microsoft thinks about being a serious player in the sort of, what we think is like playing in the living room, like playing into to consumer content consumption. Xbox obviously is a big part of that strategy, but I'm curious about ambitions beyond that as well. Talk a little bit about how you think about serving that consumer content
marketplace. Yeah, this is one of my favorite parts of the company. It's been such an area of growth for us, and I think such an area of innovation that it's really exciting. You mentioned the living room, and it's such a great phrase because it harkens back to, I think, the original Xbox strategy of getting a sort of a non-PC into the living room to be relevant in the living room. The amazing thing today is, there are 3 billion gamers on the planet, 3 billion.
Right.
And a lot of them play in the living room, but a lot of them don't. like a lot of them play on a mobile phone as they're, you know, waiting in line at a Starbucks in the morning. They'll play 10 minutes of a game, or they'll play, you know, with a bunch of PCs connected and have a bunch of friends over, or they'll play from literally anywhere. And so we've totally shifted our strategy. And most people don't know this. We still love this Xbox Series X. Consoles are awesome, but we also love the PC as a gaming platform, and we love mobile phones as a gaming platform. So the Xbox team has done this beautiful thing where they've said, hey, we've realized gamers play games on all their devices. Let's put the gamer at the center. Let's give them access to hundreds of games through this thing called Xbox Game Pass. It's a monthly subscription. You don't have to own a game anymore. You get access to hundreds of games, and you can play those games. We'll stream them from our Azure data centers, and we'll stream them to your Mac. We'll stream them to your iPhone. We'll stream them to an 8-inch, you know, Amazon Fire tablet or an tablet from Samsung. And all of a sudden, it's been like, the living room is only one place that people play. Let's meet them wherever they play. Let's let them play the games they love with the people they love across all the devices that they want to play on. And so the gamer has become the focus, as opposed to like, can we get a device in the living room?
Right.
Which is very old school Microsoft. Right. Like, let's get our stuff in that room at someone's house. And now Phil Spencer and the Xbox team are like, no. That might have worked for us early, but now the new world is, let's meet the gamer where they are. And that means leveraging our cloud platform, and you know, the Azure data center footprint is massive. Right. So we're just turning on game streaming in new countries, and it's so fun to see like the hours played just spike in a country that frankly never embraced consoles. Some countries just haven't really embraced gaming consoles, and all of a sudden they're playing, you know, Halo streamed from our cloud on their Android tablet.
You know, one question that raises, and I know we're running a little tight on time. We have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
But it does. One question, we have a reader question sort of asking about whether in the battle for the living room, to reuse that phrase, Microsoft should have a play in the video content business, right? So if you think about Netflix is going the opposite direction, right? Netflix, which has obviously a huge streaming business, is adding video game streaming. You have, whether it's Apple or Disney or Verizon or AT&T, like there's a lot of companies who are playing in that business, and obviously it's a large market.
Yeah.
But Microsoft has not really directly played there. Does that feel like a hole in your strategy?
I don't think so. I mean, look, I think gaming and movie watching and TV watching, I just frankly think of these as entertainment, and we are great at gaming. You know, we have wonderful game franchises. You know, we've made some big acquisitions, Minecraft a bunch of years ago, Bethesda very recently. You know, we've built a huge set of assets around game publishing.
Right.
And I think that's where we play in the entertainment space, as opposed to thinking we're going to, create, hire people to create TV shows or movie shows and, movies rather, that was part of our entertainment. Of course, through the Xbox, we have awesome partnerships with just about everybody, Netflix, Apple TV, Hulu. So you can use an Xbox as a way to get to that content. But if you're asking me, do we plan on creating our own video content that would compete with a Netflix video content? The gaming business is massive. We are a small player. We have huge growth potential. I think that's where you're going to see us play in the entertainment world. I did find it really interesting that, the CEO of Netflix.
Reed Hastings, yeah.
Hastings, not Hoffman from LinkedIn. Reed Hastings said, I worry less about HBO and I worry more about Fortnite. And that was a fascinating statement because, and it's something we realized, the number of hours that people game, and it's more social than watching a TV show, and it's sort of stickier, and it's an amazing, amazing business. It's going mainstream. And for us, I think we can try to be just best in class in this part of entertainment, knowing that we're going to have tons of competition. And of course, that's
great. I saw an interesting piece of data this morning. There's a new Wall Street report about a survey of teenagers and their media consumption and technology consumption. And one of the questions was whether they consider themselves gamers. And the number of yeses was like well over half. right? So like almost all of them think of themselves as gamers.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable. And also, you know, as you think about, well, maybe they may not stay gamers forever, but not that many people were thinking of themselves as gamers when I was a teenager. Right?
Well, I think the big thing that's changed, Eric, since you and I were teenagers is gaming has become incredibly social.
Right.
And it's not, when someone says a gamer, they often think of an old school image in their head of someone being very alone and playing in a dark room. It's an incredibly social experience. You know, people play Minecraft to be with other people, you know? And so I think that's the thing a lot of people miss when they think about like TV versus games. It's like, they're actually pretty different.
Yeah, it's a little different than what I was sitting in front of the computer playing, you know, Doom or something.
Same as me.
So I know we're running out of time. I do want to just sort of acknowledge one of the readers talked about, which I thought was fascinating, was that you were at Microsoft when they had the company had its first $1 billion quarter
in
1993. And at some point in the next, you know, year or so, Microsoft's going to have its first $50 billion quarter. We're not that far away from that.
That's true.
That's just an astonishing period. And it does raise some questions about like, where does it go from here, right? Like you're already, you know, it's one of the, after Apple, the most valuable company, certainly listed in the US market. How do you think about the growth opportunities now from the way that you thought about them when you were just starting out here like 30 years ago?
Yeah, well, you know, I never even thought of it when I was starting. You know, you don't really think about the company's quarterly results. But you're right. The scale is just, it's quite stunning. And, you know, if we think about wanting to grow 10, 15, 20%, you know, you're talking about growing the size of huge companies in a single year. And so I would say that we need to look at markets that are very, very large and that are growing and that Microsoft has real differentiation in. And we have sort of a right to be in. And that's the simple lens that we look at to look at, you know, okay, what's the next adjacent thing for us to go get very, very committed to?
Right.
And, you know, that might be security, which we answered that one 10 years ago. And, you know, here we are as a huge security vendor. That might be, you know, vertical clouds. We've launched a bunch of Microsoft clouds for vertical industries, Microsoft Cloud for financial services, for healthcare, for retail, and getting deeper into the needs of a particular vertical, usually through partners with our horizontal technology. But we're always looking for that, you know, $1 billion business is too small. You know, it's got to be 10 billion. It's got to be something quite, quite large.
Right.
And so that's just the state of where we are as a company. And not every company is burdened with that. It's a wonderful
thing to have, though, Chris.
But lots of other companies, you know, a new $1 billion business would be amazing. And so, you know, it's just a little bit of a uniqueness of what it's like to be at Microsoft. But it's a thrill. You know, none of us will be at our jobs forever. And every day I'm so grateful that I get to work at a company that has this kind of platform that can do, you know, real good in the world, whether it's sustainability, whether it's, you know, a long, long list of things. So, you know, it's a wonderful position to be in, but we all know it doesn't last forever. So you got to enjoy it. You got to enjoy it while you're in it.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I know you've got a hard stop and have to go. I want to thank everyone for being with us today. Please join us on Barron's Live tomorrow. We'll have MarketWatch climate reporter Rachel Beals is speaking with A-Line Wealth CIO Peter Klein on investing in water and mega drought and some other interesting topics. Thank you all for being with us today, and please be safe. Talk to you all soon.